From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In 1986, writer André Debus pulled off the highway to help a couple of people who were in an accident. While helping them, he was hit by another car. The accident crippled him. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the ways the accident changed his body, his life, and his writing. Also, a life in jazz that started as a life in the military. Willie Ruff tells us how he joined the segregated army at age 14 and learned to play French horn. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead remembers Miles Davis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The foreign minister of Haiti said today that President Jean-Bertrand Aristide has been arrested by mutinous soldiers and taken to army headquarters. Rebel soldiers fired at the president's home this morning, but were reportedly driven back by Aristide supporters who took to the streets. Aristide was reported safe in an undisclosed location, but he returned to the National Palace when the situation appeared to be calmer. The foreign minister said that Aristide's government is negotiating with the army to at least save the president's life. A National Education Goals panel today described the condition of America's schools as sobering. The report is the first in a series intended to measure the nation's progress in six education goals. The goals were established 2 years ago by President Bush and the nation's governors. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports from the White House.
According to the report, fewer than one in five students is competent in math. Many 11th graders can't write a coherent paragraph. And discipline problems in the classroom are on the rise. The good news is that the percentage of students earning a high school degree is at an all-time high, and drug use among students is on the decline. The report says 26 federal agencies are spending about $59 billion in support of education, but it makes no argument for or against more spending. The report's most alarming conclusion, though, is that researchers really don't know very much about some key problems, such as the physical and emotional health of preschool children, or the true levels of illiteracy, both in schools and in the workforce. The lack of accurate and uniform data, the report concludes, is seriously hampering education reform. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
The defense in the government's case against former Panamanian President Manuel Noriega is attempting to paint the prosecution's star witness as an opportunist. Melissa Mancini reports from Miami.
Panamanian drug pilot Floyd Carlton offered the most damaging testimony to Noriega's case last week. He testified the general had firsthand knowledge of drug deals. Carlton said Noriega even went so far as to negotiate the price of using his country as a stopover point for cocaine shipments headed to the U.S. This morning, Noriega's defense attorney had his first opportunity to question the government informant. Defense attorney Frank Rubino pointed out the former pilot originally faced a prison term of 145 years plus life with no parole. But because he cut a deal with U.S. prosecutors, Carlton now faces a sentence of 20 years or less. Rubino pointed out Carlton has the government's okay to keep all of his drug profits, including property and cash. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
Stock prices rose today on Wall Street, closing out the third quarter of the year on an optimistic note. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 11 points to close at 3,016. This is NPR. Former Romanian Prime Minister Petre Roman made a bid to return to power today after claiming that last week's protests in Bucharest were part of a communist plot to overthrow the government. Roman was forced to resign after riots led by miners who were protesting his stringent new economic measures. Today, Roman told President Ion Iliescu that he has the right to form a new government because his National Salvation Front party holds a majority in the parliament. A National Salvation Front senator charged that the protests were incited by communists determined to overthrow Iliescu. He named the alleged coup leaders and demanded that they be arrested. The United Nations nuclear weapons inspectors who've been in Iraq say its nuclear program was sophisticated and extensive. The BBC's Barnaby Mason reports from Bahrain, where the special UN commission charged with disarming Iraq is based.
The leader of the inspection team, Mr. David Kay of the International Atomic Energy Agency, was involved in a four-day confrontation with the Iraqi authorities in Baghdad. He said the quality and depth of the Iraqi nuclear program was impressive in its sophistication. The facilities were far better than most he'd seen in Western Europe or North America. Mr. Kay said the huge quantities of documents they'd collected were on their way to the Atomic Energy Agency's headquarters in Vienna. He declined to give any details of the foreign companies involved in supplying equipment to Iraq. There was a lengthy job of analysis to do. Mr. Kay said controls on exports had to be tightened, and a lot of work was going on to try to incorporate the lessons of Iraq into the regular inspections designed to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons.
The BBC's Barnaby Mason. There was more unrest today in many of the Soviet Union's republics, prompting Soviet President Gorbachev to threaten to resign if the republics fail to agree on a plan for a new union. In the Republic of Tajikistan, demonstrators forced the communist-led parliament to lift a state of emergency. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sometimes there is an event in your life that is so tragic that as long as you live, you will think of your life as dividing into two parts, before and after. Writer Andre Debuse is living that kind of life. On a summer night in 1986, he was driving along a highway near Boston when he spotted a woman standing beside her car, which was stopped in the third lane. He pulled off the side of the road to see if anyone was hurt. The woman was bleeding and crying. She and her brother had hit a motorcycle. As the three tried to flag down more help, they were struck by an oncoming car. The brother was killed. The sister was uninjured. Debuse was crippled by the accident. He lost one leg and lost all use of the other. He has been helped financially in the intervening years by benefit readings of well-known writers like John Irving and John Updike, who admire his work, and by a MacArthur grant. But it's been very difficult for Debuse to resume writing. I spoke to Andre Debuse in June, when his first nonfiction book had just been published. It's a collection of old and new personal essays called Broken Vessels. This is the opening of a piece about the accident called Lights of the Long Night.
I remember the headlights, but I do not remember the car hitting Luis Santiago and me, and I do not remember the sounds our bodies made. Luis died, either in the ambulance or later that night in the hospital. He was 23 years old. I do not remember leaving the ground my two legs stood on for the last instant in my life, then moving through the air, over the car's hood and windshield and roof, and falling on his trunk. I remember lying on my back on that trunk and asking someone, what happened? I did not lose consciousness. The car did not injure my head or my neck or my spine. It broke my right hand and scraped both arms near my wrists, so my wife believes I covered my face with my arms as I fell. I lay for a while on the trunk talking to a young man, then to a woman who was a state trooper. Then I was in an ambulance, stopped on the highway, talking to a state trooper, a man, while he cut my trousers and my right western boot. That morning, my wife saw the left boot on the side of the highway while she was driving home from the hospital in Boston. The car had knocked it off my foot. The state troopers got the boot from my wife, but I did not leave the hospital with a left foot or, below the middle of my knee, a left leg.
You know, one of the reasons why I asked you to read that story instead of asking you to tell it is that I thought you might feel almost tired of telling the story about what happened to you.
I am.
Are you?
You know, 5 years I've been telling that story. Actually, I don't know if I ever, well, you know, in the first few years it used to scare me and I had to take a Xanax to tell it, and now...
It used to scare you just to tell a story?
Yeah.
And have you told it enough so that it's just a story now? I mean...
Actually, I told it to some teenage girls I was teaching. This was only last fall. I had a new girl that night. She asked what happened, and another girl started telling her, because I didn't want to. But the other girl wasn't telling it right, so I told it. And when they left, I got very anxious. Yeah, and I did, in fact, take a tranquilizer and then go check with a psychologist to see if what was happening was what I thought was happening.
Which was what?
I said, you know, they left. I started to pay bills, and I started getting very anxious, and I wondered what was wrong. And then I thought, well, you've just told a story about almost getting killed and told it at night, which I usually try to avoid doing. And it's messed you up.
Why is it harder to tell it at night?
Oh, I think it has to do with darkness and death. When I got home from the hospital in 86, in September, I got frightened every day at sunset and took a Xanax when the sun went down. And always assumed, no one's told me any different, that it's because I almost died. And I didn't like seeing the sun go down. And to this day, I sleep with my bedroom door open and all the shades up, because that not being, being closed in reminds me of the hospital, where there were windows, but, they looked out over an alley. So, there was window looking onto brick without much light.
Right.
I think so. I mean, I was close.
This is the story of the moment that's probably most changed your life. And it's probably the story you've told the most, at least in the past few years. And I'm wondering how the telling of the story has changed over time.
It hasn't really changed much. Since writing that, I've come to terms with the lives of the other people involved. In other words, I've done some forgiving, which was necessary. Especially of the driver who ran over us. And, of course, she should be forgiven. It was only an accident, but, I took it personally for about 8 or 9 months. But basically, the story hasn't changed. But as I get now nearly 5 years from it, I'm even more deeply grateful and awed, because I've heard since then of so many other accidents. Grateful and awed that I was struck by a fast-moving vehicle on a highway and emerged as healthy as I did. I mean, I should be dead.
So when you met the driver?
No, I never...
You never met the driver?
No, I never met her. I was brought up in Catholic school, so I learned as a little boy, to pray for people you don't like. And I started doing that for her, using her name, because I really felt hatred. And I knew the only way to get rid of it was praying. And I never felt good about it when I was praying. But finally, after a few months, with some help from somebody else who was actually praying with me, I saw it from the woman's point of view.
In asking you about the telling of the story and how you tell it and how the telling has changed, I think one of the things I'm trying to find out is if you've tried to find a way of telling the story so that what people feel isn't pity, but a larger sense of the fragility of life. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's ways of telling stories so that people feel sorry for you, and there's other ways of telling it so that they feel something larger than that.
Every time I tell it to somebody, it's always with awe and gratitude. I've met a lot of injured people since my injury because of the mutual help that we go for. And everyone I know who's crippled has used the word gratitude and grateful, because what happened to us was bad enough to have made things worse, So... that's always the way I remember it. Well, I remember it with fear, too. And I never lost consciousness. A nurse told me no one ever remembers the point of impact, but I know two injured people who do, and I'm hoping that I never remember that.
Yeah, don't you think it's a blessing to not remember
that? Oh, I think
it's
a great blessing. I remember the headlights, and then I remember being on her trunk, and then learning that I never lost consciousness. So... my eyes must have seen, that grill and hood and windshield coming, and I'm just very glad I don't remember that.
Now, you're a very literary man. I mean, you read a lot, you write a lot. And we know all about tragedy and the way people react to, horrible things in their lives from literature, but that doesn't stop us from having to experience it when it happens to us. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
it doesn't
I do.
Save you from anything. Did you feel that, like, what you knew from literature, from, like, the greatest writing that you'd read helped you in any way?
Oh, yes, I do. I do. I think if I had been younger and had a different background, I may have had a worse response, or even older with a different background. growing up with in Christian Brothers schools, as I did, it was a Catholic schools, growing up with the Passion of Christ as your example of this is how things are going to be, gives you the expectation of suffering. And then, you know, I started reading serious literature when I was about 18, and most of that is about what? People who love each other, people who hurt each other, people who lose. And so you could say I've been spending most of my spiritual and mental life dealing with suffering of others, from Christ to Natasha in War and Peace, right?
Has your reading changed in recent years?
Has my reading changed? Yeah. I tend to read more of the New Testament and less of anything else. The first year of my injury, I didn't notice it until someone said to me, "What are you reading?" And I said, "I'm only reading the New Testament and histories of Marines." And the guy said, "Well, that makes sense." And then I realized I was doing both for my spirit, trying to get courage, endurance, grace, patience, wisdom.
What did the history of the Marines give you?
Oh, vivid examples of people suffering and enduring and, you know, having true grit and resilience.
You've talked about forgiveness, and of course, you know, there's a lot about forgiveness in the New Testament. How long did it take you to forgive the person who ran you down?
From July until the following May.
You're laughing in a way that's really not a very long time at all, you know.
No,
people can go through a lifetime without that kind of forgiveness.
That was pretty long. And, you know, I had, I'm also laughing because my anger wasn't really rooted in anything reasonable. I thought she should have sent me flowers or a card in the hospital, you know. But I'm sure her attorney, being what they are, said, you know, don't even lick a postage stamp with his name in your mind or else you're going to get messed up. And after some months, really, really only through prayer, and I don't want to sound like, you know, some freak, this is just very normal prayers. I mentioned her name every morning and prayed for her because I knew that, you know, I couldn't go around hating somebody. It's just, it destroys you. You can't carry that around in your heart. And, you know, finally the grace came to me to be in the car as she would have been on that night driving. And then I realized, you know, she didn't do anything wrong. She had a bad night, you know. And she didn't do anything wrong either. She wasn't drinking. She wasn't on drugs. She just didn't see us. And it was a... You know, she didn't break any laws. There was never anything done to her.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with writer Andre Dubuis, and he's just published his first nonfiction book. It's a collection of essays, most of them very personal, called Broken Vessels. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Andre Dubuis. How long did it take you to start writing again after the accident?
Oof. I'm still working on that. I have been writing. I wrote 10 of those essays. I've written 4 stories. I got hit in July. I wrote a very short story in January. Well, actually, I was trying to write in the hospital. So I've always been writing since the accident. But it's been very difficult to create something whole. And I'm starting to understand now in my 5th year that the healing is long. I mean, people have told me this all along, that the body, the spirit, the mind are all damaged and everything's going to come back slowly. But I'm starting to believe it now.
So is it mostly physical distress that's held you back from writing more?
I don't really know. Only in the past few weeks, this May, I've begun to feel some energy and peace that I have never felt since being hurt in 86. Begun to feel even almost like I used to feel, as well as I remember how I used to feel. On Thanksgiving of 86, Tobias Wolff, that wonderful, wonderful writer and friend, phoned me. I was still in a cast. I was home. I was hurting. And as soon as he said, "This is Toby," I started crying. I said, "Toby, I can't write. Why can't I write?" You know, this was 3-4 months after I got run over. He said, "Because your body's broken and your body and spirit are one, and they're both mending." And I think that's been going on for a long time. I mean, you know, I still have aches and pains and fatigue every day, but I think a new gift is coming. I really do. I think writing is going to become more what it was before I got run over than what it's been since I got run over, which has been like, you know, chasing a blowing piece of paper on a windy playground.
Well, one of the new pieces in your new collection, In one of those pieces, you say that the best person for a crippled man to cry with is a good physical therapist. Have you gotten a new sense of what's best to bring to or to leave to a professional, you know, as opposed to someone who you're very intimate with, someone in your family?
I went to a professional psychologist in 89, which was nearly 3 years after the accident, because I woke up every morning crying, and one morning I couldn't stop. And so I guess I learned from that, you know, when you can't move, it's time to go to the professionals. What the professional did in 1 hour, though, was get me to contact two other crippled friends, and one came over 2 days later, taught me to drive a car. And so I saw this guy, the professional, probably for about 6 or 8 weeks. And, he was very good. He said, "You're not depressed. You're sad because you lost your legs, and you'll always be sad, and you'll never replace them," which is exactly what all the friends I called said. You know, you will always wake up missing your legs, and you will never get over that. And I had made the mistake of expecting one day to wake up as you do from the flu and say, "Wow, that was tough. Now I feel great. I'm myself again." It never happened. So before I, just lay there crying for a few days, I used to call myself a bad cripple. I was angry at myself for not being a cheerful cripple. Then I found out from the other guys who were more experienced cripples than I that they weren't cheerful either. They had just learned to expect to wake up feeling this, and expect to go through this each day and night, you know, the psychic pain, the spiritual, the physical. And it's nice to have that brother and sisterhood.
You use the word cripple to describe your condition?
I do, but I think that's because I'm a writer. I've never liked euphemisms. You know, I don't say passed away. I say dead. One of my older children came to me in the hospital and said, "You're not disabled, you're physically challenged." I said, "No, you're physically challenged. You're breathing hard from climbing the stairs. I'm disabled." My friends who are active disabled people like to be called disabled, so I call them disabled. But cripple is a good old-fashioned word for me, you know. And that's what I would have written before if I write a story about somebody who was crippled.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Andre Debuse, and he has a new collection of essays, and it's called Broken Vessels. I don't know, I guess it was a year or two after your accident, you were separated from your third wife.
Mm-hmm.
And
1 year, just about.
1 year. And I was wondering if you've thought a lot about whether it was the relationship or the accident that, you know, and how the accident changed the relationship, you know, that was responsible for the separation.
Yeah, I have, and it's not too personal a question. It's just one that I can't answer because I don't have the answers. The thing is about marriage is my own and everybody else's. I always assume there are so many mysteries that I will never understand anybody's any more than they do. So, you know, would we have would we still be married if I hadn't got run over? I don't know. I really don't know. I hope so. I don't know. I know the accident did something. And I know that I've only learned this spring, realized this spring, just thinking back on myself, that I was a little crazy for at least a year, but I think mostly most of two. And still am. Things get distorted when you've been on your legs for, you know, nearly 50 years, and then all of a sudden you're sitting, you're always looking up at people, steps are always problems, bathrooms are always problems, traveling is horrendous, it's frightening, it's stressful, it's helpless. You're always in someone else's hands. The access is never right. You know, the world is not curbs. Well, of course, the world is eating, drinking, sleeping, being clean, emptying one's body waste, and all of that has to do with access. So, but, you know, this can get very boring to listen to, and it's actually been a problem with my writing. I've had a hard time in fiction. I was writing a story last fall about a woman with, let's see, a husband and three children. And my notes were to get everybody up in the morning and get breakfast and get that done in one paragraph. I went, Terry, 2,400 words before I got him out of the house. And I read those 2,400 words to my fiction workshop that meets at my house on Thursdays. And as soon as I finished reading it, I said, this is really about somebody in a wheelchair. I didn't know that. But it took me another month or so to realize that I was spending so much time. There were some pretty nice sentences there, too, but it's all madness. I was spending so much time on that story because I celebrated her getting out of bed and putting her boots on while standing up. Walking to the bathroom, standing up from the toilet, standing at the lavatory in the mirror, going downstairs, standing at the stove. I mean, you know, it was Ginger Rogers I was doing. I was choreographing. I thought, oh, my God, I've not only lost height perception, I can't tell how tall people are anymore, but I've lost the proper perspective for biped fictional characters.
Well, why not write fiction about somebody who is in a wheelchair, who is crippled? Why not? And why hold yourself back from that if it seems like that's what you're writing anyways?
Because I don't think I'll feel like I've gotten back until I can write something resounding about somebody who has legs. I think this is also the truth. Usually, as a writer, if something has really happened to me, I write about it in an essay. I usually write fiction about things that bother me about the world or fascinate me, but are not really very personal. So if I'm going to put somebody in a wheelchair, you know, I might as well just do an essay.
Let me ask you, is one of the great paradoxes of this accident that the accident has brought more attention to you and your writing, but at the same time it's made it more difficult for you to write?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Well, I want to wish you the best with your health and with your writing and your new book and everything. And I thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. And I wish the best to you.
Writer Andre Debuse. Our interview was first broadcast last June. Debuse's latest book is a collection of personal essays called Broken Vessels. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Coming up, a talk with jazz French hornist Willie Ruff. He grew up in the segregated South and came of age in the segregated army. Now he teaches at Yale and performs around the world with his longtime musical partner, pianist Dwight Mitchell. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead pays tribute to Miles Davis by playing some of his most significant recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Haiti's foreign minister says President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was arrested this afternoon by rebel soldiers at the National Palace. The minister told the Associated Press that the government was negotiating to at least save the president's life. The arrest of Aristide, who became Haiti's first freely elected president in February, capped a harrowing uprising that claimed at least 26 lives and began with mutinies last night. United Nations officials are hoping that this week will see a better understanding between their weapons inspectors and Iraqi authorities. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
The nuclear inspectors have left Iraq, but a new team of UN ballistic missile experts is heading into Baghdad tomorrow, at the same time as three UN helicopters arrive from Turkey. The helicopters will be based near Baghdad and available for all UN weapons inspections. Their first mission will be aerial surveillance for the team tracking down Scuds and visiting the site of a top-secret supergun discovered in northern Iraq. The team previously left Iraq when it was unable to carry out unrestricted helicopter flights. Now Baghdad has agreed to the flights, provided Iraqi navigators will be on board, and the UN team will limit aerial movements over parts of Baghdad. Flights are expected to begin October 3rd. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
President Bush is welcoming Moscow's response to his call for nuclear weapons cuts. A U.S. official says the Soviet ambassador met today at the White House with Brent Scowcroft, the president's national security advisor, and expressed official Soviet enthusiasm for Mr. Bush's ideas. Exxon, Alaska, and the federal government have signed off on another attempt to settle the Exxon Valdez oil spill litigation. Peter Kenyon of Alaska Public Radio reports that Governor Hickel is backing the settlement, even though the numbers are essentially the same as an offer that was rejected this spring.
Under the settlement, Exxon will plead guilty to four misdemeanor pollution charges and will pay a $150 million fine. The civil plea bargain totals $900 million over 10 years. Critics are already pointing out that the extended payment period reduces the civil payments to less than $500 million, and the only real increase in the criminal fine is $25 million. But for Governor Hickel, this settlement is much better than anything that's likely to be gained in court.
I really believe this is a good settlement. We focused on it. Let's get it behind us. Why spend the next 5, 6, 7 years in court?
The criminal agreement now goes to Judge H. Russell Holland for his approval. If he rejects it, like he did an earlier settlement, all parties may withdraw. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Kenyon in Anchorage.
The stock market advanced today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 11 points to 3016.77. Advances led declines. Trading was moderate, with about 147 million shares changing hands. This is National Public Radio News. The Bank of Credit and Commerce reportedly transmitted money to Palestinian terrorist Abu Nidal in an effort to foster goodwill in the Arab world. The revelation by a former high-ranking BCCI official supports a perception that the Arab-owned bank, already under investigation as a money-laundering vehicle for drug dealers and other crimes, was also an instrument of Arab foreign policy. The fragile week-long ceasefire in the Yugoslav Republic of Croatia has collapsed, with a massive assault in the eastern section of the republic by hundreds of federal tanks and heavy artillery. Pierre Vickery reports from Zagreb.
Hundreds of Yugoslav Federal Army tanks and armored personnel carriers have crossed the Serbian border into Croatia at the start of another offensive in the east of the republic. Belgrade television says the attack became necessary after the besieged federal garrison in Vukovar appealed for assistance from the Yugoslav army. The assault is a clear breach of the week-long ceasefire and appears an attempt by the federal army to seize as much Croatian territory as possible before Monday, when Croatia officially implements its independence declaration. Heavy fighting is reported in many parts of the republic, with Bjelovar, Gospic, Zadar and Pakrac all coming under Federal Army attack. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
A fire official in Cranston, Rhode Island, says there's a riot underway at the state's prison's maximum security unit. Authorities report at least five small fires at the prison. There are no immediate reports of hostages, and it's not clear who's in control of the building. Senator Bob Kerry of Nebraska has announced he'll run for the White House in 1992. In his opening campaign speech in Lincoln, Kerry criticized the past two Republican presidents, saying Presidents Bush and Reagan have racked up a back-breaking national debt. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There aren't many French horn players in jazz. Willie Ruff is one of the better known. He was featured on the classic Miles Davis Gil Evans album Miles Ahead. Billy Strayhorn wrote a composition for Ruff, and he's performed around the world with his musical partner of many years, pianist Dwight Mitchell. The duo was the subject of a recent book by William Zinsser. Now Ruff has expanded on the story with his autobiography, A Call to Assembly. It tells the story of growing up in the segregated South, coming of age in the segregated army, going north to study at Yale, and years later returning to Yale as a teacher. Before we meet Ruff, let's listen to the Mitchell-Ruff duo playing Ill Wind from their new recording, Virtuoso Elegance in Jazz. Is really the story of a life, and I want to go back to what was quite a turning point in your young life, and that is when you were age 13 growing up in Alabama. Mm-hmm. Your mother died of tuberculosis.
Right.
Your father was already separated from your mother and living in another state. What did you think would become of you?
I had no idea, Terry, what would become of me. I was completely lost and had absolutely a lot of hope, but no direction, and it was only through music. Music was the agency that the music, and going into the military at 14 years old, like I did, was my deliverance.
Now, you enlisted when you were 14.
Right.
How did you forge the papers to get yourself in underage?
Well, I should explain that this was a very, the military of 1946 was a very different military than we know now. It was completely and severely segregated. All blacks were off to themselves and had always been up to that point. So that I wanted to get into this situation of intense learning and intense possibilities for excellence that I had seen in all of these black military men who had gone on before me. And I knew at age 14 that if I could get myself into this group of Army, and especially the Air Force, the Tuskegee Airmen, to get among them, because these were the best educated young men in uniform in America, white or black at that time, you see. And I ended up on this all-black Air Force base commanded by a Colonel B.O. Davis, Jr., who was the first, who became the first three-star black general. And it was there that I had all of my opportunities laid before me, shown how to pursue them, tutored by officers, officers' wives, older men, and got out of the Army at 17 and went directly to Yale as a freshman.
Didn't you look a little bit young at age 14? Did everybody get the point that you had forged your way into the military?
I'm sure they did. I looked like a Cub Scout, and I'm sure that also was a part of the great blessing. I was treated as a child. I was not pushed ahead of anything that was possible for me. I was chastised. I was disciplined the way parents discipline children. I was spanked and given beatings when I was bad. I couldn't use ugly words or smoke cigarettes or drink and go out with fast women. I had to wait till later.
So nobody ever tried to discover you and root you out?
Only one. My bandmaster, the first one, Mr. Ruffin, the ward officer, did, simply because he suspected I was too young. And he rode away from my birth certificate and confronted me with it. And I started to cry when he threatened to send me home, and he said I could relax because he had done the same thing. He joined when he was 16, and he had become a musician there, got all of his education through there, had the GI Bill, and continued his education. And so that confrontation was another great relief. He took that as an opportunity to step in and supervise my progress from there. And it was largely due to his efforts that I was able to get out when I got out in 1949 and go to Yale.
Huh. Now, you started playing the French horn while you were in the military.
That's right.
You had to talk your way into playing it, didn't they? Basically think it was too difficult an instrument.
That's right. I was a drummer when I went in, and there were much better drummers in the band, and it was soon apparent that I couldn't keep up. So they said, well, you got to go back to the infantry outfit. And this was in Cheyenne, Wyoming, 40 degrees below zero outside. And I said, I got to find something in this band that I can learn to play and learn it so I can stay here. And I spotted the French horn. I always loved the sound of it, but I knew how hard it was, and they fought against letting me learn to play it because nobody else there was playing it, and I knew they needed it, and if I got good enough on that, then I wouldn't be displaced again. I wouldn't be kicked out because nobody else was going to come around and play over my head.
Now, nobody wanted to teach you how to play it.
Well, nobody knew exactly, so I had to solicit help from other instrumentalists, baritone horn players and trombonists and clarinetists and flute players and all that. So I was kind of fumbling in the dark, but I was given great instructions on musicality, not technical aspects of the horn. I was taught how to tell a story with music.
Did you basically have to teach yourself from French horn books how to play, since
yes.
Nobody in the band knew how to play French horn or could teach you the technique?
Terry, that's exactly it. You hit it right on the head. I had to get a book and start from the beginning, and the book didn't have the fingerings in it. I had to sort of play that by ear, and I didn't know then that there were several possibilities, fingering possibilities for every note on the French horn, and I was choosing the ones that were flatter or sharper or not so well in tune. So by the time I taught myself how to play all the notes, very few of them were in tune.
So once you, was there a point where you had to relearn everything that you had learned?
Yes, indeed. I was. I fell into the hands of a fabulous teacher named Abe Quignaz in Columbus, Ohio, and he started me all over again, and that was a great blessing because suddenly the horn made sense. I could tell a story in tune.
When was the first time you heard how the French horn was really supposed to sound? I don't know if you'd been to symphonies before that or had classical records. And it's not the kind of music you can hear at the local club or at the bar. Yeah,
true. I heard it for the first time on records. But then I was attracted to that sound by the sound of a great contralto in my hometown of Sheffield, Alabama, named Miss Celia Appleton. And Miss Celia sounded like the French horn when she sang. And then I discovered that Marian Anderson also did. So these two reasons were enough for me to be so very strongly attracted to the sound of this instrument.
After you left the military, you ended up at Yale University.
Yes.
How did you get in? How did you know how to apply and where to apply to and all that? Were you helped at the military? Did they encourage you to do it?
Well, what happened, Terry, was that I read a jazz magazine in which there was an interview with the great Charlie Parker. And Charlie Parker was asked the question by the interviewer. He said, Bird, if you could do exactly what you wanted to do for the next several years with your musical life, what would you do? And Charlie Parker said, that's easy. He said, there's a little German cat teaching composition at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. He said, I would enroll in school there and sit at Hindemith's feet and learn me some music. That was good enough for me. I didn't know Hindemith's name from anybody else's name. But I knew that if Charlie Parker wanted to study with him, that was very hip. So I asked around and found that indeed Hindemith was there. And I had relatives in New Haven. My sisters and brothers had moved there. So I applied and was given an audition. And the GI Bill took care of the whole thing, the whole undergraduate years and graduate school.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is musician Willie Ruff, who's probably best known for his jazz French horn playing and for his work with Dwight Mitchell in the Mitchell-Ruff duo. And Willie Ruff's just written a new autobiography, and we'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Musician Willie Ruff is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography called A Call to Assembly. You've played with the pianist Dwight Mitchell for how many years now? A long time.
36 years as a duo, and that's not even counting what the 3 years we were together in the Army.
Silly question, but what keeps you together? Few marriages last that long.
That's true. I think what keeps us together, the glue that binds, is the strength of our beginnings together in the military. We were taught by the same teachers at the same time. We were learning our craft together in a fabulously supportive environment as teenagers, and we can't get above it.
More than most jazz musicians, a lot of your career has not been in the clubs. It's been in the classroom. It's been abroad.
Yes.
Is that a direction that you chose?
Yeah, absolutely, Terry. We chose this direction early on in our careers. We wanted to have the concert stage. We wanted access to children's concerts. We wanted their ears. We wanted their minds. We wanted to share with them the magic of this fabulous gift that is unique to America. No other country has produced anything like jazz. And we're so proud of it, and we're so lucky, we think, the Mitchell Ruff Duo, to be in the position to take it around the world and to share it with other audiences, that we could never get enough of it.
Do you practice your horn anymore?
Oh, Lord, do I ever practice. I spend my life with that thing. I almost sleep with it, eh? And I try to get it better and better and better all the time. I soothe it and call it pretty names. I call my horn Lena. Lena Horn. Because anybody with a name like that and a name of such a pretty woman has to behave.
How many horns do you have?
I have a spare, but it's nothing like Lena.
Is the place you're living in Alabama like a small town?
Oh, yes. I don't even live in a small town. I live out in the woods, way back out in the woods where the hoot owls court the chickens.
What do you like about living isolated like that?
Peace and quiet, and I can get up out of the bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and practice the horn, and if anybody hears it, they are trespassing.
And it's their problem.
Right.
Okay, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, again for the invitation.
Willie Ruff's autobiography, A Call to Assembly, is published by Viking. This is Fresh Air. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, a report card for education. And education doesn't fare so well. A new settlement from Exxon with the state of Alaska is announced today by the governor of Alaska. It's more money. Robert Kerry has thrown his hat in the ring. The Democrats have a new candidate, the senator from Nebraska. More on the president's decisions to unilaterally cut arms, and we're going to see what we can find out about the situation in Haiti. At this point, it's somewhere between a demonstration and a rebellion. We'll make some calls and see what we can find out for you. That's on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz trumpeter Miles Davis died on Saturday at the age of 65. Miles was such a colorful and controversial figure, it's easy to concentrate on aspects of his personal life, his stormy marriage to Cicely Tyson, the way he turned his back on audiences, and his occasional outbursts of racial antagonism. Although, as jazz critic Kevin Whitehead notes, Miles often employed white musicians. Kevin says the reason to remember Miles Davis is his music. So Kevin has several key recordings to play for us. This is from a 1949 session found on the album Birth of the Cool. ¶¶
Birth of the Cool is a quintessential Miles Davis album in that it pointed the way for a whole style of music, cool jazz, that other folks created while Miles had already moved on to something else. The album was really the creation of several arrangers, but Miles Davis usually gets most of the credit. As in other cases, there's some justification for that. The whole project reflected values he personified, like economy of gesture, understatement, and lyricism. On the composition Move, written by Denzel Best and arranged by John Lewis, the short trumpet solo that follows the melody demonstrates Miles's knack for getting to the point without wasting a note. Miles Davis led a band in the mid-1960s that had even more impact on other musicians than The Birth of the Cool did. That was the so-called Classic Quintet, with saxophonist Wayne Shorter, pianist Herbie Hancock, bassist Ron Carter, and drummer Tony Williams. The band's greatest period of influence was the 1980s, thanks to Wynton Marsalis, whose earliest albums were heavily indebted to the quintet. For Marsalis and many of the bands he's influenced, Davis's mid-60s music was still the latest in modern jazz. The tune called 81 is from the Miles Davis Quintet's first studio album, ESP, from 1964. This piece, by Davis and Ron Carter, is vintage Miles because it's so spare, another indication the trumpeter was and is one of jazz's great minimalists. From the late 60s on, Miles Davis played heavily electrified jazz, much to the disgust of conservatives like Wynton Marsalis, who have accused Davis of selling out. But listeners found some of his electric music so hard to take, his U.S. record company declined to release some albums that had come out overseas. That's not selling out, that's paying out. Miles's electric records don't all sound as perpetually fresh as Birth of the Cool or ESP do. But Miles used electronic gadgets more intelligently than most jazz musicians have. In the early 70s, he was enamored of a favorite toy of rock guitar players, the wah-wah pedal. But no guitarist ever used it quite like this. From that, it's not hard to hear why Miles said he was influenced by James Brown back then. It can be hard to believe that all the music we've heard here is the work of the same person, and these few examples don't span every significant aspect of Davis's art. But they underscore something that was always implicit in his recordings, that there are many right ways to play jazz. I hope Gabriel likes his music.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Bob Alls, Thad Kirk, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Chris Burton directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about movies with Pauline Kael. Also, we talk with novelist and critic Doris Grumbach about turning 70, the subject of her new memoir. She was miserably depressed when she turned 70, not just because she was getting older, but also because much younger friends were dying of AIDS. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.